Text messages between Cincinnati's city manager and police chief shed more light on the days leading up to the chief being placed on administrative leave, while the chief's calendar shows how much she was meeting with city leaders this summer after a street brawl downtown put Cincinnati in the national spotlight. This is Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Today on our weekly news review, what these public records reveal, plus efforts to regulate intoxicating hemp and synthetic kratom in Ohio, and a look at how communities around Ohio celebrate Halloween. Joining me now are WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian and Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterick. Welcome back, Paula and Chris.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thanks, Lucy.
Paula, you reviewed the calendars of several city leaders. How often was Police Chief Thiege meeting with the mayor or city manager in the weeks after that street brawl that happened downtown in late July?
She met with either Mayor Aftab Pureval or City Manager Cheryl Long at least 20 times in 3 weeks, often 2 to 3 times per day. And probably it probably more often than that, it's some of the calendar's spots were left blank or set aside without details. Those are just the detailed meetings on the official public calendars. So it shows how heavily involved the mayor and the city manager were in how Chief Thiege was doing her job after that brawl. And it shows exactly who the mayor was meeting with and who Chief Thiege was meeting with as well.
What can you tell us about the mayor's meetings? Did that kind of illuminate any more about his involvement in all this, you know, in the discussions about public safety?
Well, he was meeting with a lot of business leaders, a lot of CEOs, a lot of downtown business owners, the Chamber, 3CDC, Visit Cincy, P&G, Fifth Third, Richter and Phillips, Brittany Ruby Miller, Bob Deck. I mean, the list goes on. So, you know, obviously the business community downtown was very concerned about what had happened and, you know, if it was going to have an impact on their business. The mayor also spent a lot of time with Black pastors and reverends at different churches. And he spent a lot of time meeting with either the city solicitor, different city council members, and his administration.
Well, Chris, fast forward to earlier this month when the city manager asked the chief to resign. I know you reviewed messages the chief and city manager exchanged right before that. Did they shed more light on the city manager's reasoning for asking the chief to resign?
Not per se. There wasn't any text messages saying, hey, this is why I'm putting you on leave. But what we did find is that on October 15th, before in the hours, the morning really, before the city manager summoned Chief Thiege back from a conference in Denver, the chief had sent her and the city's human resources director an email kind of broaching the idea of retirement. She wrote, October 20th is my 36-year anniversary with CPD. And as you know, I can't stay here forever, so I just want a plan. And she was also trying to kind of settle maybe some discrepancies in her, you know, the amount of service time that she had. So that was very notable because later in the afternoon, that is when the city manager summoned her back from Denver to meet with her. And during the intervening hours, 700 WLW host Bill Cunningham basically said that, they're going to, you know, the number of days that she's going to be chief are numbered. And so this, I think, caused, you know, a lot of consternation at City Hall. And after, you know, just an hour or so after that, that is when the city manager asked her to come back.
Well, and by that time, when the city manager asked her to come back, the chief had already heard about this report on WLW. And Chris, it sounds like the chief was also hearing some support from the community before the city manager recalled her from that conference in Denver. Is that right?
That's correct. So she basically, you know, quoted a text message that she had received from the Cincinnati Reds. And it was a very supportive text message from one of the executives saying that she has a tough job and, you know, you're a great leader and I have total confidence in you and don't let the critics get you down. And that was kind of the flavor of that text message. Mm-hmm. And clearly that, you know, clearly she had, you know, the message also refers to the WLW broadcast. And her comment, the chief's comment on that was maybe just WLW being typical dramatic was the thing that she said about it.
Hmm. Well, Paula, you referenced an email the city manager sent to Chief Thege in August. Talk about that. Did that indicate any kind of tension or friction between the two of them?
Yes, it did. I mean, after Chief Thege was placed on leave, one of the things her lawyer said at that press conference was that she was hamstrung from doing her job, that she was controlled by the administration. And a lot of the ideas that she had to reduce crime, she wasn't able to do. And I think that that August 15th email supports what her attorney was saying, because City Manager Cheryl Long sent her an email saying that she was caught off guard by her announcement of a police chief's task force at a recent press conference and told her that in the future, all communications and external meetings and announcements have to be reviewed by her and the city spokesperson ahead of time. So it basically removed all of her free speech completely. And what's interesting is in looking at the calendars, Chief Thege went to a safety briefing at the Cincinnati Regional Chamber on August 15th at 11 a.m. An hour later is when City Manager Cheryl Long sent her that email saying, basically, I don't want you saying anything that doesn't go through me anymore. So that was very interesting. And I think supported what her attorney was trying to say.
Chris, how has the administration responded to questions about that August email?
I was curious about that because when I read the email, I was like, are they trying to restrict her from talking to Cincinnati City Council members, which they would, of course, probably take umbrage at. And the answer to that was no. And basically, the administration's take on this email was that, you know, this was aimed at kind of outside discussions with politicians, and that they wanted that kind of communication, outside discussions with politicians outside of the city, I should say, and that they wanted that type of communications to go through a person named Morgan Sutter, who kind of deals with government affairs for the city. And, you know, that was communicated not only to the chief, but to other departments as well. So their take on the email is that it was less restrictive than maybe it reads in person. But I certainly read it as being pretty restrictive, you know, at first glance as well.
Well, Chris, I know on Wednesday, some of Chief Thege's supporters attended the regular city council meeting. Can you talk about what happened there?
I was not there, but from what I've been read or whatever, they were, you know, typically, you know, there were, you know, Chief Thege's family members and friends, and they were, you know, very vocal in saying that this was unjustified. One of the things that caught my attention was one of her relatives suggested that people vote for someone other than the mayor, which seems like a, you know, there's already been escalation and further escalation there in that respect. So it was certainly, you know, noteworthy.
Well, Chris, I know also the city has hired this outside law firm to conduct an investigation into, I guess, Chief Thege's leadership. What can you tell us about which firm was hired? What do we know about what they're investigating?
Yeah, I mean, remember when the city manager put the chief on leave, the reason that was stated was we want to examine her effectiveness as a police chief. And so what they've done is they've hired Frost Brown Todd, which is, you know, has a major local presence. The attorneys that will be doing the work, at least the lead attorney, is from Columbus. So there's a little bit of an arm's length away from Cincinnati in that respect. But they, you know, they have a number of duties as, you know, as they proceed with their work. They're going to look at whether she's been an effective leader, as I said, and also been quote, a leader within the context of city government, including by furthering the broader goals and objectives of the city administration. And they're also going to look at whether she's violated any policies and whether she disregarded the best practices in running the Cincinnati Police Department to the detriment of public safety and crime prevention. These are all quotes out of Frost Brown Todd's contract with the city, which the city released earlier this week.
Paula, have you heard any more from Chief Thigy's attorney since this contract was signed with Frost Brown Todd, since these texts and emails and, you know, the calendars that you've looked at since all of that has been in the news?
No, I did reach out. I told him what I would be reporting and asked, you know, for a comment and was not given one. I also reached out to the city manager's office and the mayor's office. You know, there's been a lot of silence over this at this point. I think the only way we're getting information now is through public records requests. And, you know, while some are coming back, some are slow. So I guess we'll just have to wait to see how this all shakes out.
Yeah. Chris, I know we talked to you, we've talked in the past about how the chief's lawyer says that she's being used as a political scapegoat by the mayor and city manager. The mayor has denied that. Has the lawyer said anything to you since these texts and emails and all that became public?
No, we've, you know, like Paula said, we've reached out a number of times. I mean, it would be interesting to hear his take on some of this, but often with lawyers, they, you know, they are dealing with potential litigants, and more is often, or less is more, I think, in some lawyers' philosophy when it comes to speaking with the media about things that are going to be litigated in court, because, of course, anything they say to us could be used in that litigation down the road. And so, you know, I expect that they're trying to be cautious. Nevertheless, it would be good to know their take on some of these things. The stories are not super complete without understanding exactly, you know, for example, the August email, how the chief interpreted that email from Cheryl Long to her regarding, you know, who she's allowed to speak to and all of that kind of stuff.
Paula, you talked. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I'm hoping that maybe they're just being extra quiet with the election a few days away, and that maybe once that passes, people will be able to speak more freely, because I do feel like the public deserves as much information as possible. You know, this is their city. These are their public documents. They have a right to know and understand how their city is being run.
Well, and we don't have a ton of time left, but Paula, I know you talked with local political experts this week. Do they think all of this will have an impact on the city council race and the election that's just a few days away?
Overall, they predicted low turnout, but they did predict that turnout will be higher than it would have been if there was no summer violence and there was none of these, you know, high profile incidents. So, you know, it's you never know until people actually vote, but they did say that this is making more city residents pay attention to how their city's being run and whether that translates into more voters and how they vote. I'm not sure. They also predicted that the Democrats could lose between 1 and 3 seats on council, that their stronghold could be broken by non-Democrats, Republicans, or charter committee candidates.
Well, I've been talking with WCPO9 I-Team reporter Paula Christian and Cincinnati Business Courier reporter and columnist Chris Wetterich. Thank you both so much for your time today. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
Thanks, Lucy.
Thank you, Lucy.
Up next, what the federal government shutdown means for Head Start programs in Ohio. This is Cincinnati Edition. The federal government shutdown could close some Head Start programs in Ohio, leaving thousands of children with nowhere to go. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me in this recorded interview to discuss that, along with other state government news, are Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Jesse Ballmert and Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson. Welcome back, Jesse and Sarah.
Happy Friday. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
Afternoon.
Yeah, whatever it is. So, Jesse, we've talked about the shutdown's impact on federal government employees, what it means for people who rely on food assistance. Tell us about what it means for Head Start.
Yeah, so Head Start is a federally funded program that provides free childcare and early childhood education to children up through age 5 for lower income families. And essentially, these locations are funded at like different points of the year. So there are 7 of them that should have this money be rolling out to them on November 1st, but that's not going to happen. And speaking with Highland County's Head Start coordinator, she said they can't just keep spending money with no expectation that they will be reimbursed. And so that means they're going to have to close. And these children who come there for childcare are going to have to find, you know, a relative or someone else to take care of them in this meantime.
How many programs will be affected in Ohio, Jesse, and how many children do they serve?
Yeah, so there are 7 programs across the state that are helping about 3,700 children. Now, some of them, like the Coshocton County location, got a private donation and some matching funds, so they're going to be able to float it for another couple weeks. But a lot of these agencies are just making really tough decisions for their employees, for the families that they serve, and for the children.
I know in your story you reported that these are mostly rural programs that are affected. Why is that?
I think it's really just the luck of the draw, like when these particular deadlines came up. So these are the ones that on November 1st, they are going to get their new funds, except for because of the federal shutdown, they do not. Unfortunately, these are areas that don't have a lot of other child care options. So you're kind of hitting the hardest hit already.
And are there different ways that these programs are responding? You mentioned some are getting private funding, but what are they doing in terms of interactions with their families and the children?
Yeah, so talking with the folks in Highland County, they said that they're sending kids home with bags and entertainment and educational resources, kind of similar to how they handled the COVID-19 pandemic, which I know parents have fond memories of. So I think they're trying to make it work. They're really hoping that there's going to be a federal fix sooner rather than later. But even if the government restarted on November 2nd, it's still going to take a little time to get this funding stream back up and running.
Well, that is tough news for those parents. But Sarah, you've got good news for people who consume and sell what Governor DeWine calls intoxicating hemp. What's the latest with that?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of movement on this front in the last couple of weeks in Columbus. Namely, a couple of weeks ago, Governor Mike DeWine issued an executive order hoping to put a short-term ban on the sales of what the state calls intoxicating hemp. So those are products that are not technically defined as marijuana or cannabis by the federal government or the state government, but some of them may act kind of like marijuana. They induce a high, and they have a range of different ingredients connected back to hemp. So DeWine issued this ban, and then it was blocked by a judge in court. And that judge has extended the ban through December. I think some of the reading in between the lines here is Governor DeWine has said he hopes lawmakers act in the interim. And of course, there was action on that as well.
Well, and remind us, I know that this some hemp manufacturers and retailers filed this lawsuit that resulted in the pause of this ban. Remind us why they sued. What's the basis of their lawsuit?
So they argued that Governor DeWine doesn't really technically have the authority to just unilaterally ban hemp for 90 days. DeWine's argument was he was doing it under what's called an adulterated consumer product emergency. He says that these products are not what they say they are. But hemp is legal in Ohio federally. The federal government deregulated it in 2018, and the state government moved shortly after. So these hemp retailers say, you know, DeWine is putting this unilateral ban on these products that are not technically illegal, and it's going to put us out of business.
You mentioned that Governor DeWine really wanted state lawmakers to take action on this, and now they're working on legislation to regulate these products. Tell us about that legislation and where it stands.
Yeah, so this has been an ongoing process, like I said, and negotiations kind of picked back up when lawmakers came back to town this fall. So the bill that passed out of the Ohio House, I think it was last week, maybe it was 2 weeks ago at this point, but earlier this month, it makes changes to both marijuana law and then also hemp law. So when we're talking specifically about hemp, instead of, you know, banning the products or earlier versions of this bill, also what they did was they moved the products behind marijuana dispensary counters. So hemp retailers said, well, that's basically a de facto ban because, you know, why? We still can't sell these products. So you have some folks like Republican Representative Tex Fisher who have been big proponents of these hemp retailers. And so now what the bill looks like, the bill that passed out of the House, is it would license, the state would license hemp retailers, similar to how they license marijuana retailers. Now, it's kind of an interesting scenario because a lot of the folks who are selling quote unquote intoxicating hemp, that's not the only thing they sell. It's maybe a gas station or a corner store. So, you know, they're also selling pop and chips and things like that. But for those specific retailers who just sell hemp under this bill, they could get licensed to sell hemp. And it also carves out CBD and THC drinks. So, you know, you might see those on menus at bars and breweries. They've become pretty popular, especially among the younger generations. Bars could still sell those drinks, those intoxicating hemp drinks, on site for consumption, and grocery stores and other places with liquor licenses could also, you know, sell them as carry out. So it carves out those drinks, which was another big concern with DeWine's order because, you know, I think people see a difference between the sale of, you know, maybe edibles that are being sold to any age. Maybe they're at a gas station and maybe the gas station's carding, but maybe the gas station isn't carding. And a bar where you go, you have to show your ID. You have to say that, you know, you can't buy alcohol if you're not 21. So I think folks kind of saw a difference between that.
You mentioned the Ohio House passed this bill. How quickly could it move through the state Senate? Could it be passed before the next hearing in this court case?
So it's tough to say. I think I, especially on this issue, because this issue has been debated back and forth, and lawmakers there just have very ranging opinions on it. Procedurally, what happens now is the bill was kicked back to the Senate. The Senate voted not to agree to the changes in the bill. So lawmakers are going to go behind closed doors in what's called conference committee, and they're going to work out the differences in the bill and come to an agreement. So I think that it's everyone's hope, both the House and the Senate. I've heard from Republican lawmakers on both sides. And of course, these bills passed in a bipartisan nature in the House. I think the hope is to get it done by the time they leave for Thanksgiving. I think November 19th is lawmakers' last scheduled session. So that would definitely be before December. But, you know, negotiations could hit a snag and we're kind of back where we're at.
Well, another new bill, Sarah, would regulate kratom. Who's behind that and what would that one do?
Yeah, so that was introduced by Republican Senator Bill Blessing. He introduced a similar bill last year, but this one is a little bit different because it bans synthetic kratom and some of the alkaloids that go into synthetic kratom. So namely what's called 7-OH, and then it regulates natural kratom. So kratom, probably a smaller customer base than folks who are, you know, maybe using hemp or marijuana. But you've seen more of it on the shelves at gas stations, probably right next to that intoxicating hemp. And the federal government has also expressed some concerns because it has opioid-like qualities, 7-OH, but it's totally legal. And so you have seen instances. I mean, I think the state government has recorded as many as like 200 overdose deaths that they say are connected to kratom in the last couple of years.
Have lawmakers tried to regulate kratom before?
There hasn't been as, you know, much movement as there's been on this hemp and marijuana issue. But I do wonder if, because you see kind of a similar regulatory structure that gets the ball rolling on kratom. And of course, we go back to the governor, because the governor wanted the pharmacy board to unilaterally, you know, schedule kratom as a drug in Ohio, which would have made it illegal. And he put that on pause. And so I do wonder if that gets kind of the ball rolling in the legislature this year. But Blessing introduced, like I said, a similar version of this bill last year or last General Assembly, and it didn't really go anywhere.
What's next with this bill?
So Senator Blessing tells me he hopes it gets some committee hearings soon. And then, you know, we'll see. He said he's amenable to changes. So we'll see what happens and what the appetite is. I imagine, you know, the legislature is pretty busy with a lot of things right now. So it may not be until next year that it gets a hearing, but they still have a couple weeks left of committees and of session.
Well, Jesse, tell us about another bill. This one would allow young adults to buy handguns. What's the Ohio law now, and what would change under this legislation?
Yeah, so the Ohio law right now is that if you're over 21, you can buy a handgun from a licensed dealer. You could purchase one from like a friend or relative without that kind of licensed dealer process. Or if you're 18 and over, you can buy long guns, so rifles, shotguns. This proposal would allow 18 to 20-year-olds to buy handguns from licensed dealers. The big challenge with that is it's in conflict with federal law.
So the conflict with federal law, that does sound like a big challenge. Are there already legal fights underway over this federal law ban?
Yeah, that seems to be one of the reasons why this bill was introduced, to kind of join this legal fight over whether 18 to 20-year-olds should be able to buy handguns from licensed dealers. And there have been a variety of lawsuits that have been filed over this. In January, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals, which represents like Louisiana, Mississippi, Texas, said that 18 to 20-year-olds should be able to purchase guns in this manner because they have Second Amendment rights. They are able to, you know, serve in the army, they are legal adults, et cetera. So, you know, why is there this age restriction on 18 to 20-year-olds that there isn't on a 21-year-old?
Is there any chance Congress could take this up and kind of resolve the issue at that level?
That would be kind of the easiest way to address this issue, but Congress has been a little busy, I guess, or maybe not very busy, reopening the government. So I think Second Amendment rights advocates are not optimistic that Congress would tackle this issue. So there are a couple of like dueling federal court lawsuits that have gone different ways on this. So it's possible the U.S. Supreme Court will take a look at it one day.
Well, what's next with this bill in Ohio?
So this bill was introduced recently. So it is in the Ohio Senate. It'll kind of go through the legislative process. Ohio has been, the Ohio legislature, which is controlled by Republicans, has been favorable to Second Amendment pro-gun legislation in the past. We eliminated licensing and training requirements on concealed carry a couple years ago. So this is certainly legislation that you could see them moving.
Well, I've been talking with Ohio Public Media State House News Bureau correspondent Sarah Donaldson and Cincinnati Enquirer reporter Jesse Ballmer. Thank you both so much for your time today. Up next, a look at how communities across Ohio celebrate spooky season. This is Cincinnati Edition. Each Friday this month, the Ohio Newsroom has been celebrating the state's spookier side. You're tuned to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. I'm Lucy May. Joining me to talk about where they've gone and the tricks and treats they've picked up in their travels are the Ohio Newsroom reporters Kendall Crawford and Aaron Gottsacker. Thank you so much for being here.
Hello. Happy Halloween.
Hi, Lucy.
Hey. So, Kendall, that theme music was a dead giveaway. We're talking about the Twilight Zone, or really the man behind the Twilight Zone. Tell us about Rod Serling and how he ended up in Ohio.
Yeah, so Rod Serling, he was born in Binghamton, New York, but he enlists as a paratrooper in World War II. And when he comes back, he just has this moment of, I'm not sure what I'm going to do with my life. I'm not sure how I'm going to cope with the things that I saw. And so he just decides to follow his older brother to Antioch College in Yellow Springs. And it's there that he has this whole idea that he's going to be a PE teacher. He goes in, but like every good Twilight Zone episode, there's a twist. He becomes instead a writer. He discovers his love for writing at Antioch.
I understand he got his start writing for TV in Cincinnati.
Yeah, so that's really interesting. After he discovers his love for writing, he starts working at different radio stations across Ohio and then ends up in Cincinnati. So he's working for WLW. He's not really loving it. He wants to write more, you know, more than just commercially type stuff. And so he starts secretly under the table freelancing scripts for their rival, WKRC. And I believe, I cannot remember the first name, but he changes his last name so he's not in trouble, just to Sterling. He really hides it well.
Very tricky. Very tricky.
Yeah. And that's where he starts doing some more of the types of scripts that you would expect from the guy that created the Twilight Zone. He gets into those anthology series things, tackling people's fears. The show that he works on, called The Storm, is just about conflict between people. And so it's really a predecessor to what he does on national TV.
Much of what he brought to writing in terms of content and in terms of his basic themes, I think they have their origin in life in the Midwest with, solid people who try to live a good life. And there's a moral to the stories that we tell each other. And I think that comes from having lived here.
So tell us who we just heard from and more about what he's talking about.
Yeah, that's Michael Sanders. He is a university professor at the University of Cincinnati who teaches media. And he has been spending so much of his time collecting the scripts of Rod Serling of his time in Cincinnati, in Ohio. And he has, you know, pay stubs from actors. He's got this big collection that he's just hobbled away. And his hope is to kind of tell the story about how Ohio has influenced Rod Serling. And he's talking about that there, where he thinks that he learned what it means to tackle the stories of ordinary people so that he could then take that and put them in these extraordinary situations. And he says that's very a Midwest thing of Rod Serling, and that he learned that not only in his hometown of Binghamton, but also here in Ohio.
And were there things that Rod Serling could kind of communicate through the Twilight Zone, almost political things that he was able to work into the series?
Yeah. One of the things that struck me that, a Rod Serling enthusiast talked with me about was that he called him a moralist in disguise. Like, everything he was writing had a message of what you should take from it, how you should act in these situations. But since he like put an alien in there or did something, you know, with time travel, you weren't aware that somebody was teaching you a lesson. It didn't feel didactic. Something he said to me was that, like, you know, an alien can say something that a Democrat or a Republican can't say. And I thought that was really true. If you watch The Twilight Zone again, there are these lessons that anyone can take away. But you don't feel like you're being handed a lecture from your parents or something.
Yeah. Well, you mentioned he went to Antioch College. How did Antioch honor him this month?
Yeah. So they finally unveiled a historical marker here at Antioch College. And that was really exciting for the people who love Rod Serling, because they really do feel like Ohio is where he was able to first like craft the Twilight Zone, like first get the ideas to make that happen. And so to them to finally have a space to recognize Ohio's role in that was super exciting. And at Antioch College too, he actually went back later in life. He taught there, he taught creative writing. And so to honor kind of his contributions that he did to help the next generation of people that would be writing TV.
Any idea what Rod Serling might have thought of that?
Yes, I spoke with his daughter, Ann Serling, and she said in his time, he didn't really see himself as anything remarkable. I mean, he was a celebrity. Like, people recognized him because his face was on TV and he's doing this long-running series that everybody loves, but he never felt like his writing would outlast him. And so she thought that if he could see the historical marker unveiled, he would just be shocked in the most pleasant of ways and just really happy to find his writing was more than just adequate for his time.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a wonderful way for Antioch to celebrate the month of Halloween and honor Rod Serling. Aaron Mansfield has a different way of celebrating spooky season. Tell us the origin story for Crow Fest. Why is Mansfield crazy for crows?
Well, Mansfield is crazy for crows because the city is at the center of Ohio's crow migration. So every year around this time, thousands of crows descend in the city, and the woods behind the Mansfield Art Center is a particularly popular spot for these birds. So I talked to Jennifer Beavis. She's the center's marketing and development director, and she says, you know, between the cawing and the wings flapping, the sound of these birds is just deafening. And so 4 years ago, the Art Center had a two-week window until their next show. And they thought, well, hey, what if we just do a pop-up show honoring these birds? They did that. They asked the community to submit artwork. They played the birds outside. And the art show was a hit. And so they've been bringing it back every year since.
Wow. What kind of stuff was on display this year?
There's so much stuff on display. Just any kind of medium you can imagine, it's there. There's crows carved out of wood. There's pottery pieces, fiber art. There's like a vest with handmade feathers on it. There's a whole documentary about the crow migration in Ohio. And one of my favorite pieces, it's called The Crow Pollock. It's a photo of a concrete sidewalk splattered with bird poop. And so as you can imagine, the birds aren't always quite as popular in the city.
I bet. So you mentioned that there are some unpleasant things that come with the crow migration. What's the appeal of crows for Jennifer Beavis, this woman who runs the Art Center, and so many other people?
Well, I think there's just a fascination with crows. You know, like a flock of crows is called a murder, so that's pretty spooky. But the birds are really smart. They can hold a grudge that passes down through generations of crows, which is amazing. And I think just the way they're represented in mythology and literature, you know, they're really seen as this ominous harbinger of doom. And so I think that symbolism just appeals to a lot of people.
Oh. Has this whole thing changed the way Jennifer Beavis thinks about crows herself?
She says it has. It inspired her to become friends with the crows. So she started feeding them in her backyard. And she says they bring her little treats like sticks. And she's just recognized how they develop specific routines. And she says this whole experience has just given her another level of respect for crows. And it makes celebrating them even more fun.
Wow. Okay. Well, respect. I have a lot of respect for someone that you met this month, Kendall. I think of myself as an average pumpkin carver, maybe a little above average, but you met a pumpkin carving artist this month.
It's a performance art. I'm performing for their audience. So it really is kind of a mix of the actual art itself and being able to do it in front of people so they can see that it's not AI, you know, that they can see that it's real.
Tell us about this squash carver.
Yes, he calls himself the squash carver, which is amazing.
It is.
And his real name is Gus Smith Heisler. And he, every October, September, he gets The pumpkin I saw was 900 pounds. 900 pounds or more pumpkins.
Oh, my gosh.
And yeah, he puts them on a pallet. He sets his tools up, sticks a couple knives in the pumpkin, and then he gets to work, and he makes I saw him make a really fantastical dragon. He's made OSU's mascot, Brutus. He does everything. He goes to the zoo sometimes and carves eagles. And he does this kind of like, he calls it subtractive sculpture. So it's not your typical jack-o'-lantern where you're carving all the way through and you got to deal with all the pumpkin guts. He's slowly taking away like layers of the pumpkin to make this art that's really, really awesome.
How did he get into this and how long has he been doing it?
Yeah, so he started actually by growing the giant pumpkins. So he met someone that was doing it as a hobby, and he was an engineer, and he was like, I have some free time. Let me start growing these 900-pound pumpkins. And so he started taking these pumpkins to competitions, and at one of the contests, he was just thinking, he was like, well, someone needs to carve this. Like, there's so much room. And the person with him was like, well, you have a knife. Go ahead. And so he starts carving, and he's getting to work. And pretty soon people are coming up to him, and they're like, how long have you been carving? And he's like, about an hour. And they're like, no, we mean professionally. Oh, he's like, yeah, an hour, I guess. So from there, he's just been doing it now for more than 20 years. He's retired from his engineering job, and he does this basically all the fall season, like spends all his time on this. He makes little videos that he posts online and works with brands to make pumpkins. And so he's really, it turned into something he was like, hey, why not try to something he does professionally now.
What does he say he likes best about all of this?
Yeah. So I mean, would for the quote at the top, he was talking about, right, that this is a performance art. And so he's often doing these at these fall festivals where there are a bunch of people around. And so his favorite part is like when the younger kids come up and they're like, oh my gosh, that's a dragon. How did you do that? And he just really loves the answering questions of the part of it. And I think it inspires him because he gets a little bit of an opportunity to talk with them as well. And basically say like, hey, if you want to do something like this, you should just try it out. And he wants people, even if it's not pumpkins, to like pursue their artistic passions.
Does he sculpt anything else?
Yes. So as you'd imagine, there's not a lot of pumpkins in the spring and summer. And so he gets bored. And so he has found other snacks that he can sculpt. So he sculpts cheese, chocolate, vegetables, but pumpkins, squash, to be more specific, are his like true love, I guess I would say. He really, really loves the Halloween season, but he has found other ways to keep it going.
When he's got scraps for a 900-pound block of chocolate, I'm there for it. I will just get a bucket and take whatever he carves away.
It sure probably like smells better, right? Because yeah. I was asking, like, do you just go about life smelling like a pumpkin yeah. this whole time? Which isn't the worst
it
thing,
isn't
but
the worst, yeah.
Yeah, pumpkin chunks in your shoes yeah. and such. Yeah.
So, does he have any tips for average pumpkin carvers like me?
Yes, his most important tip and advice is to not cut yourself, which I was like, noted.
Yeah.
Try your best. But I think his real level of advice is to like go outside your boundaries kind of slowly and push yourself, take a little bit more of risk. So if you're like me and you're doing the typical like triangle eyes and a smiley creepy face, maybe add a little detail this year, maybe give him a hat or or make him stick his tongue out or something, and try to push yourself to do something different. If it doesn't work out, you can always create it into something else. He says the pumpkin is very forgiving. So try to remember that when you're carving and think of it as a little bit of a challenge as well as a Halloween tradition.
Oh, well, that's really good advice. Very sweet advice. Speaking of sweet, so Erin, the candy company that makes Dum Dums is in Ohio. Where in Ohio and how did it get started?
Yeah, that's right. Spangler Candy is in the far northwest Ohio, like the tippy top corner of Ohio. And it started more than a century ago in 1906. And there's this man, Arthur Spangler. He actually had a paper route. And so he saved up all his money. He saved $450. And he went to the Courthouse Square in Defiance, Ohio. And he bought the Gold Leaf Baking Company out of bankruptcy. And he decided to give baking a stab, but like his predecessors, it just didn't bring in much dough. And so he and his brother decided to give chocolate a try. And so they would deliver chocolates with a horse and buggy. They had an ice block in the back of their buggy to keep the chocolate cold. And they did that for a really long time until about the 1950s when they acquired Dum Dum Suckers.
Well, yeah. How did they get into the lollipop business? What happened there?
Well, the Akron Candy Company, they acquired it from them. So it was another Ohio company, but that was in the 50s. They slowly started expanding production and distribution. And so now it's a nationally recognized brand, obviously.
Yeah. How many dum-dums does Spangler make? I mean, I feel like I see millions of them at banks and doctor's offices and all over the place.
Yeah, you probably do. They make 12 million suckers every day, not every year, every day.
Wow.
And altogether, they make 17 million pieces of candy every day. And another way to think of that is 200,000 pounds of candy.
Holy moly. Why are dum-dums such popular Halloween treats?
Yeah, they're normally, like, on a normal given day, dum-dums are like the 15th or 16th most popular candy. But at Halloween, they rise to the 5th or 6th most popular candy brand. And I think there's a few reasons for that. You know, they're really easy to unwrap. So if you're a little kid, that's great. But also, like, there's kind of a dum-dum for everybody. The people I talked to at the Spangler Candy Factory said, this is like, if you're a young kid, probably one of the first decisions you ever get to make. Like, which flavor of dum-dum do you want? I know that's something that resonates with me. I certainly remember picking out my favorite flavors.
Yeah. So it seems like there are a bazillion flavors of dum-dums. There are so many.
There are. Yeah, they said the most popular flavors are cotton candy, blue raspberry, and then root beer and cream soda. Those have very, very loyal followings. But this year, there's also a lot of new flavors. So if you maybe want to branch out from those standards, there's spicy pineapple, chocolate orange, blueberry donut, and then there's a whole bag of pickle flavored dum-dums. I don't know if that's for me, but maybe it is for you.
Yeah, that seems like it would be more trick than treat, but maybe for some people. So, Erin, what's your favorite flavor?
I do really like the root beer suckers.
Okay.
Yeah, what about you, Lucy?
I'm a butterscotch person. What about you, Kendall?
I'm cherry through and through.
Okay.
Always.
Okay. Are there any flavors you will not eat, Kendall? Like, if you see them, you're just like, no, thank you.
Say I have grape, I avoid grape at all costs. But I actually think I would try the pickle dum-dums for the record.
I'm glad we have that on the record. How about you, Erin? Any that you avoid?
I'm not so sure about those pickle dum-dums, I have to say.
Well, that's good. We have two very different opinions and perspectives for the Ohio Newsroom. Erin, what other kind of candy does Spangler make?
They make a bunch of other candy, circus peanuts. I saw those being made. Sweethearts, those conversation hearts at Valentine's Day, Necco wafers. And then they're also the largest U.S. manufacturer of candy canes, too.
That's a perfect way to end. I mean, you can already find those at Kroger these days. So
you sure can. Halloween is almost over.
That's right. Well, I've been talking with the Ohio Newsroom reporters, Erin Gottsacker and Kendall Crawford. Thank you both so much for your time today and happy Halloween.
Happy Halloween. Thank you.
You've been listening to Cincinnati Edition on WVXU. Our producer is Selena Reeder. Associate producer is Harper Carlton. Technical directors today are Ella Rowan and Carlos Lopez-Cornu. I'm Lucy May. Thanks so much for listening.